Today's seminar is being given by Dr. Gruley, who's over here. She has a BS and Masters of Engineering from the University of Lincoln, and an MBA and a PhD from the University of Washington. And she serves as an adjunct faculty in technology strategy, entrepreneurship, and venture capital in the business school and the Department of Computer Science and Engineering here at the University of Washington. She's a veteran of the high-tech startups space, and she also works with the Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship, involving students in all aspects of company creation, technology, commercialization, and investment. And she's currently the executive director of the Alliance of Angel Seed Funds, specializing in investment in early-stage entrepreneurs, which UAB. So her personal interest in the environment drove her to lead the first cross-listed task in the College of the Environment, and she's going to discuss that today.
Good morning. First of all, to people up the back there, do I need a microphone? No, good. I hate those things. Hi. I think that this morning's talk is going to be a lot less academic than the ones you're used to this early morning, so hopefully I'd like you to ask questions. Because what I'm going to talk about is we started this new environmental challenge across campus this year, and we would love, first of all, for any of you to take part. It's going to be in April. All of the deadlines are still ahead of us. But the idea behind this environmental innovation challenge came originally from Connie Barassa-Shaw, who runs the entrepreneurship center that I work with, and Dr. Alan Leffen, who at the time was the assistant director in the Applied Physics Lab. She's actually now at the Civic Science Center. But we had this idea. We run a business plan competition. How many people here have heard of business plan competition on campus? Okay, well, just briefly, the Entrepreneurship Center runs this business plan competition for people who are interested in starting businesses to write business plans every year. And the first prize is $25,000. And it's a huge big deal. People who have won this business plan competition have literally gone on and started incredible companies. One of the women who won it a couple of years ago, Amber Radcliffe, started a biotech company of all things. They're now on their third round of financing. You know, they're up to like $25 million in money in there. And every year we have the people who won this competition for the last couple of years have been cross-campus teams. So they've either been, you know, the business school of computer science, or the business school and the medical school, or the business school, and mostly the biotech people, because they tend to be very entrepreneurial. And we got this idea of, you know, what's really not happening here is we're not seeing people build prototypes and build real working models or real computer simulations. And how do we really get the science students and the engineering students and the people from the new college and the environment involved in something that's meaningful for them? You know, if your goal is not to make a ton of money off this, the business plan competition is probably not the best vehicle for you. So we came across our, you know, also with kind of everybody's dawning, you know, you guys are way ahead of the curve, but for most people, the sort of concept of the environment is finally becoming mainstream. So we said, well, why not capitalize on that too and put together something like an environmental challenge across campus. And when we started to look, there are something like 75 different bits and pieces of environmental programs all across campus. You know, everywhere from forestry to public affairs to, believe it or not, the business school. And we thought that could we really get a bunch of students from all over campus to start working together on teams to do this environmental challenge. So to do the inaugural challenge, we pulled together the College of the Environment, the business school, you know, through the Entrepreneurship Center, and the College of Engineering. They're all co-sponsoring this challenge this year. And that means that like, not only they put their name behind it, but their money behind it and the weight behind it. And we're trying to recruit students from all over campus to do that. So let me talk just a little bit about what exactly it is. We chose these three. You know, first of all, the environment. Voodoo. But I teach an evening class, so I never dare do that at night because everybody falls asleep. I guess it's hard. No, no, it's fine. Good. This hour morning it works. So the idea was that, you know, if we could get a lot of the environmental students to do the idea generation, and this is talking about stereotyping your groups, right? Then we could have the engineering people really help with concept, proof of concept, and building the prototypes. And then the business school people would help on sort of the market feasibility. So what the environmental challenge is, you know, not just a working I'll talk about that one next. Not just a, you know, to build a working prototype, but what we also want people to do is some sort of market feasibility.
And, you know, for that, we don't mean a full-blown business plan where you figure out, you know, who the customer is, what your cost is going to be per unit of whatever you put out there. That's not what we're interested in. What we're interested in is, can you take this idea and show us that there's actually a need for it? So if I think about it, you know, what we want people to do is build a working prototype, but also then come up with somewhere between a 5- and 7-page executive summary that says, you know, if we build this, here is the group of people that will benefit. And the nice thing about this one is, you don't have to prove that you're going to make $1 million out of it. You just have to prove that, you know, somebody is really going to benefit from this innovation. The other thing, by the way, is I tend to speak really quickly, and especially when I get more excited about what I'm talking about. So please interrupt or put up your hand or something if I'm speaking too fast. And I certainly want questions as we go along. So to any of you here, so how much of this sounds even vaguely interesting? You know, if you're beyond, you know, the deadlines right now, how many people think they might like to be involved in something like this at some stage? Okay, cool. And stop and, you know, stop me and ask questions as we go along, because I don't have that many slides anyway. So what else do I want to say? Oh yeah, the first prize is $10,000. And not only that, so the first prize is $10,000, but we're also going to have 3 sort of best idea prizes for $2,500 each. And, you know, this is the first year, we're not quite sure what those prizes are for yet. You know, they may be for sort of the best sustainability idea, they may be for the best developing world idea. The great thing about this is, I think kind of like this group here this morning, when I taught the sort of environmental practicum, you know, our first class to talk about ideas here, we had students from, you know, not just the business school, but from the College of the Environment, from engineering, from the schools of public affairs, from fisheries, from forestry, and we were laughing here, I was talking just before I started speaking, because, you know, I teach in business school, so we tend to be incredibly vocational. Anybody here from the business school by any chance? Okay, but I mean, would you agree that, you know, education there tends to be very focused? And, you know, from my perspective, that, you know, running this has been sort of my first time really feeling like I'm part of a university, where we actually could talk about all these great ideas and not worry about what the bottom line was, you know, straight away. But the judges then, this is one of the other reasons I'd really encourage any of you to participate. And this is one great thing about the business plan competition as well. If you take part in it, it's, you know, it would be nice to win the $10,000, but it's really an incredible experience. So, you know, it's not that you come on the final day on April 1st and present your idea. Yeah, question. You know, when I teach my other classes at night, I usually bring candy with me, and it's like, ask a question, get a candy. So, sorry. That's a great question. So the question is, if you don't know anybody across campus, how on earth do you put together a cross-functional team? So what we're trying to do this year, and we have a little bit of experience with this, and, you know, excuse me if I keep referring to business plan competition, because that's our model. So what we've done is we set up, we started, and I'll talk about this in a second, we put on an environmental practicum, which was a class, a seminar class, something like this. It met every Monday, and that's where everybody met. And then, you didn't have to take a practicum to take part in the environmental challenge. So we had, you know, a cookie pizza party once or twice during the quarter, and invited everybody you could think of. And, you know, if you guys didn't hear about it, I'm sorry, to bring people in and just discuss ideas. And then the other thing that we did, and I'll talk about this again in a second, is we had an idea generation session that we invited a lot of people to. So I'll talk about that a little more. And if you don't know anybody now, the other thing is, I'm usually a good person to just email, because I always say that my only value in the business school is that, in fact, I put people in touch with other people to either work on business plans or people in the community or people in the sort of investment space that would help students develop plans and get ideas out there. One of the other things that I think this is incredibly useful for, and I don't know how many of you have gone through this experience, and I always tell my students this, is that a lot of the time when you're trying to investigate an area, some place you might want to work, it's very hard to sort of ask somebody for a quote-unquote informational interview. I don't know about you, but I used to find it incredibly awkward. You want to go talk to somebody about what they're doing to find out if it's a space you're interested in, but it's sort of an artificial thing, because you really sort of are looking for a job, but you're not, and you don't quite know how to carry off that conversation. One of the great ways to give yourself a tool to facilitate that is to be working on a project for a competition. So for the business school students in the business plan competition or others, or in this, there isn't anybody in town, I'll tell you, who won't talk to you about an environmental innovation challenge. You know, if you call them up or send them an email or get somebody like me or Connie or Pam, all our names are at the end of the presentation, you know, to help introduce you, they will be dying to talk to you about developing a prototype or a concept or a feasibility study around an environmental area. So, you know, if you get nothing else out of this talk today, remember that when you're trying to find yourself a job, one of the easiest ways to get in to talk to people is use the fact that you're a UW student working on a project and people will bend over backwards to help you. You know, we find that, especially in this, there's a lot of people. When we started to try and find our judges who are, you know, technologists, people who are venture capitalists or angels in this area, they're all dying to help. You know, green is really hot right now. And the economy's lousy. They have all the time in the world to talk to smart students. So just remember that one. So the judges, so why this thing is valuable is, the way it works is, in February you put in sort of an intent to submit, but that's not that important right now. And then you have to come up with, you know, what is the prototype or whatever you're working on. And after a while then you have to come up with roughly what's the sort of business idea or the business model or the feasibility you want to do. And at that stage, we will hook you up with a mentor in the community who will help you work on it. So here's a chance for you to pick something in an area you really want to work on. You know, find something. This year, the theme is water, by the way. You know, we're accepting plans from any area. So if your area is forestry and it's really not water-related, which is hard to think of, you know, you can still enter the Environmental Innovation Challenge. We put a theme on it, and I have a thing here on, you know, why water? When we started to think about, you know, green and environmental and reasons that we might want to look at various things, and started to look at some of the statistics. I'm not going to read them all out because, you know, you guys know these better than I do. But the thing about all this, you know, if you're not in a business school or you don't follow the business press, one of the things that's really, really important right now is green technology. And even with the new Obama administration, they're making a big push to put more energy and effort and money in the space. But water is very, very much kind of the poor stepchild. And if you just look at the numbers here about, you know, the United States consumption of water, the control of the resources that we have here in comparison to our, you know, population in the world, and a lot of the effort, especially around Seattle, around you know, green technology and environmental space, has to do with things like global warming, you know, solar energy. You know, not to say that those aren't phenomenal areas to get involved in, but let's face it, water is the single biggest issue facing the planet. As one of my advisors, one of the people on my advisory board, David Smokowski, said, you know, if I put global warming on the list of, you know, actual impact to people dying today, it's not even on the radar screen. You know, which is an incredibly short-term view in one way, but if you start to think about where the real impact of what we can do with not too many resources today, water is the area.
But does it matter that water is not, since water is not such a pressing issue, there's not like a perception that the water is a scarcity and thus people don't want to consume it all at once?
Okay, so the question
and
was,
then,
you know,
does the market.
So the question was, if there is no perception out there that, you know, exactly as I'm saying, that there is no crisis in water, you know, then there must be no market for it, because if people don't see that there's, is that the question? If
no, I'm saying that will create such a demand for water, because people will perceive it to be very important right now and not for future, clearly.
Okay, so the question is, if people don't see that there's a scarcity now, they're going to demand more than...
If people perceive that, since right now water is not just a crisis, and that helps to sort of maintain water as a public good.
Okay.
So
okay.
I mean, if you make it so that it's pricing so that it's really, really like, the thing,
mm-hmm.
like the next commodity,
mm-hmm.
I think people will start consuming it so fast.
Yeah. Well, the goal of this is not to create as a commodity. So the idea is, the question is, if there is no concept out there of the scarcity of water and that it is consumed as a public good or a common good, really. You know, how can we turn that around, really?
Yeah, so my question is, might this even backfire for society?
Yeah, so that, yeah, would it backfire if... I don't think it is. So one of the things, you know, over a billion people, you know, use unsafe drinking water. You know, millions of people die every year. Something like 90% of the highest, you know, killers in the world are waterborne pathogens. But we're not doing very much about that. And the question is why? And this gets to your answer. And the real answer is because it's a poor people's problem. There isn't a lot of money around developing solutions for the developing world. For developing solutions for, you know, the other thing is it's not sexy and it's not hot. You know, by the British Medical Association came out and said the single biggest impact. I'll give you a guess. What do you think the single biggest impact on disease around the world would be? What behavior modification would change huge number of diseases? David,
clean water.
Clean water, but what about clean water? Well, we're not talking about potable clean water for everybody. But what do you think is the single biggest thing that would change mortality statistics in a huge way across the world? I didn't hear words in the developing world.
Condom use?
What?
Condom use?
Condom use? No.
Oh.
No.
Hand washing.
Hand washing. Absolutely, hand washing. If we could just get people to wash their hands, it would have the single biggest, the British Medical Association with this huge survey of diseases across the world. But the biggest problem is that the vast majority of people don't have access to clean water. And then there's this whole sociological and cultural thing about hand washing. There's a fabulous NGO out of Seattle called Water First that operates in four countries. And they said that, you know, getting water just to these communities is one thing, but the bigger problem then is creating a whole social, you know, it's social innovation. It's not technology innovation. And a lot of entrepreneurs don't find that very exciting. So that's kind of why, you know, there's a couple of reasons the problems persist. One is because it's poor person's problem, the other is the social issue.
If you haven't seen it, there's an interesting article in the New York Times of a woman working in Ghana that hired Unilever to Colgate Palmolive and Kellogg or somebody to help her this create an advertising campaign to get people to wash their hands. And it increased, teaching them about germs didn't do it, but they came up with an advertising campaign that indicated that their hands were disgusting.
And it's interesting.
Using business techniques through advertising was interesting.
Yeah, and one of the other ones was Water First talks about when they put in a well in a community, that they set up a whole system because it's the social innovation rather than the technical innovation. So they think they set up a whole system where they appoint somebody in the village to actually charge people for water use because everybody wants the water, but you know if it is a common good and you're not charged for it, then you don't appreciate the value. And not only that, but your continued supply of water depends on the fact that you are actually washing your hands and having your children wash your hands. So that's kind of one of the things. Right, anything? There's nothing else I think we need to talk about there. So one of the more interesting panels. So what we did in the fall then, we tried to figure out, well, how do we kickstart? And this gets back to your question up there, is how do we get people together on cross-functional teams? So in the fall, we ran something like this, a seminar, and every week it was a different topic around you know, water and environmental challenges. So we started off very much on the sort of global picture of global warming. You know, everything we had, and you know, the Climate Solutions Group, we had Casey Golden from Climate Solutions come in, Alan Hamlet from the Climate Impact Group here. So we discussed everything on, you know, global warming and then what's the specific impact on the Northwest. And it was fascinating because the idea here was to help generate some ideas for people who compete in the challenge. So literally the second week, because Alan Hamlet spoken here from the Global Impact Group, his specialty is, but you know, his specialty is basically sort of the water table and the snowpack in the Northwest. And he ended up talking about, he put up all these computer models of, you know, water in the Northwest, what's going to happen with global warming, you know, where it's going to change. And he talked about the problem he had with one of the models was that the resolution around the cascades wasn't very good. So immediately after the class, two of the computer science students went and talked to him about how they could write an application to hook up his program with Google Maps to help solve that problem. And that's one of the ideas that's going forward in the competition. So that's what's been really fun about this whole class. One of the other areas then, so what we did was we started off with very much the 30,000 foot view. You know, what are the problems in the environment and the water space? Global warming, you know, global warming on a local area. We also had, you know, people from the Evans School in class who were very much interested in policy. We ended up with a great discussion about what happens with the, you know, as the snowpack recedes in the Northwest. And the vast majority of the water feeding the Columbia River, which we use, is now on Canadian territory and not here. And what does that do for sort of cross-border relations in managing the water supply? Then we started to get more into sort of the entrepreneurial side, and we brought in a couple of entrepreneurs. So we had one called Alan Weinstein, who is an amazing entrepreneur who is building wind power generation off the coast. So it's water and wind power generation. And you talk about people who take on just incredible problems. So they're setting these out 20 miles offshore. It costs $1 million per mile for the transmission cables to get to the shore. And the thing about it is, if you look in the Northwest where you might want to install these things, they're mostly in remote, I would have said remote areas like Forks, but I guess it's not remote anymore, right? It's the center of the universe. But they're in these remote areas when you actually get them to land that, you know, you have to start building, you know, transmission and generation capacity there too. So here's somebody who thinks they can do it because it's, you know, an ecologically sound way to generate power. So we have amazing entrepreneurs. Another entrepreneur, a guy called Burton Hamler, has got a company called Hydrovolts, and basically he's developed these tiny little micro turbines that you can put in really, really small bodies of water. Because if you think of energy generation from water, generally you have to have like huge falls like Niagara or whatever to generate a significant amount of water. But what he can do is he can generate micro amounts of power from, you know, irrigation channels, for instance, in the Yakima Valley. Because this turbine has a very low stall speed, so you can generate power. So you're not going to power a city, but what you might be able to do is power the irrigation system for the wineries in Yakima through their own irrigation canals. Or if you think about it in the developing world, if you do actually have that source of water that's running, just from that one source of water, you might be able to power the lights that students can read by, the kids can read by in their huts at night. So, you know, because one of the biggest problems in a lot of the developing world in small villages is that kids, their only source of light at night, if they're lucky enough to have education, is the fire, and they all end up dying of emphysema by the time they're in their 30s. If they can have lights in their huts at night to read by, that can be generated by these little microturbines, that's a great solution. And these are things that are not going to generate anybody megabucks. So that's what's really fun about this class. Then we had a panel. So because my whole background is entrepreneurship, and we talk a lot about, you know, how do you fund companies, how do you get them started, everything from angel funding. Angel funding, by the way, is, you know, wealthy individuals who put money into startup companies, to venture capitalists, which is more organized money that gets put into startups. And we had this great panel about why is there so little money in green tech funding for water. So if you look at the billions of dollars that are being spent on solar and on electric cars and, you know, anything else you can think of that's sort of, you know, quote unquote green tech, biofuels, less than 5% of it has been spent on water. Now that's expected to expand over the next couple of years, maybe up to 12%, but the thing about it is most of that's in infrastructure. So we'd be talking about building dams, which, you know, are not incredibly environmentally sensitive, but they still, in a lot of cases, get put in as sort of environmental spending. So we had a great discussion about why there is no money, you know, to develop companies or technologies in this space. And each of these, you know, seminars, the idea was to generate some ideas, and then I'll talk about some of the ideas that have come out of this and some of the projects that students will be doing for the challenge. And, you know, as I said, if not this year, maybe next year we can get you guys to take part. But there's still plenty of time for this year. We talked about forestry and the water cycle. We had Bob Bilby in from Weyerhaeuser. So some of the coolest things about this, you talk about these stereotypes that you build up in your brain. We had somebody come in, I was talking to a friend of mine who's very involved in the space, and he said, you have to get somebody to come in and just explain how the municipal water supply works. And here I am thinking, oh great, we're going to have somebody come in. Have you had anybody from the Seattle Public Utilities come in and speak here? In the past, not this time. Honest to goodness, this was one of the most fascinating conversations we had ever had. Ray Hoffman, who runs the water section, is the director of water for the Seattle Public Utilities, talked about what a job they've done over the last couple of years in conserving water use. Because, you know, they're a huge incentive to conserve because they don't have to build any new plants. If they can keep cutting the consumption, then as the population of people who are consuming the water grows, they don't have to build any new plants, so they're going to save money that way. But this one is fascinating. Ray Hoffman is one of the most fascinating people. If you ever get to talk to him, he's incredibly deep, incredibly smart. And it turns out that Seattle Public Utilities are incredibly innovative. You know, we talked a lot about where our water supply comes from. Who knows where water supply for Seattle comes from?
Cedar River Watershed, Toad River.
We're incredibly blessed here in Seattle. The water we drink hasn't been drunk by 20 people before us. You know, so we have a really clean water supply. And we talked a lot about, but there were some great ideas that came out of that around water conservation, and I'll talk about those ideas afterwards. The other person I thought was fascinating was Bob Bilby from Weyerhaeuser. Again, we know when I tend to think Weyerhaeuser, and apologies to all the forestry people here, I don't really start thinking environmental conservation, visionaries. Bob Bilby, the chief environmental scientist from Weyerhaeuser, came in and talked about, you know, trees and their relationship to streams and salmon, and what they've done over the last couple of years to mitigate the effects of forestry on, you know, rivers and salmon. And absolutely fascinating, and had everybody, you know, for that. So the other thing that was great is that Matt O'Donnell, who's the Dean of Engineering, said he'd give us $25,000 to give us grants to students to build their prototypes. So we had any of the students who were interested in building prototypes apply for funding to build their prototypes. So I just threw up some of the ideas that came out here. So from that talk that Ray Hoffman gave from Seattle Public Utilities, he literally stood there with your water bill. I mean, how many people have even looked at a water bill? How many people know how much water they consume a month? How much do you consume?
Oh, I don't know. I've looked at my water bill.
Okay. How many people know how much water they consume? How much?
Six.
No. Okay, that's it. Now, what does that stand for? Exactly. That's the problem, right? And this is exactly our problem. So water comes into your house. There's a meter running somewhere out there in the yard that kind of goes clumpy, clumpy, clump in cubic feet or whatever. That means absolutely nothing to anybody. And how can you incent people to actually conserve water? Because there is no connection between what you're using and what you're paying. You can't see it. So some of the computer science students in the class said, aha. So there are two problems with this, right? So the first problem is it's easy to put a meter out on the out on that and convert to something somebody can use. That's easy. But the problem is, again, not a technical problem, it's a social problem. Seattle Public Utilities employs a whole ton of people to go out and read those meters, and we're not going to replace the meter readers. It's just not going to happen. So, while instead, if, Connor, are you working on this one? Do you want to describe it? So here's one of the ideas that came up from out of this class. Now let's set it up so that people in the back can hear.
So there's kind of two components to it. There's one, it's more of a behavior change. Essentially, the premise is that we're developing a real-time water meter to be displayed in the household to show real-time consumption. And the second component, we're researching and developing a way to determine the volume other than reading the meter outside. So that's one component. The other component is behavior change element.
The other component is what?
The behavior change element, which is how do you display this information to somebody and make a difference and be able to report that difference and then be able to market it to somebody like Seattle Public Utilities and say, we can save you 10, 20, 30% of your usage by using this.
And so the really clever, I think these guys come up with is, you don't want to be out there on a meter, but they've got an acoustic sensor that they can couple off the pipes. And different, the water flow has a different signature depending on how much water you're using. So for instance, if you can imagine, if the water is running through the pipe, there's an acoustic sort of signature for when a toilet gets flushed, or there's a different one for when the dishwasher is on, or there's a different one. And by monitoring those and calibrating them, they can actually figure out how much water you're using and then spray it in your house and put that on with a little thing that says, by the way, this is costing you whatever. So, you know, if the lawn is being watered outside and it's pouring rain at the same time, then I might actually trigger you to look into your irrigation system. But a very clever way of getting around the social problem of you're not going to replace the meter readers, and then the real physical problem of the fact that your meter bill or your water bill is in some god unknown units that nobody can understand or relate to. You know, you used 4 to 6 of these last month. Well, what does that mean to, you know, as we used to say, around to the place of a pint?
I have a question for
you.
I think that I've heard someplace that the problem is not so much in the urban areas where there is metering, but rather in the suburban and rural areas where there are wells and there is no control or measuring whatsoever of what's been drawn there.
So the question is, so the problem really isn't an urban problem because it's not, because there it's metered and people get bills, right? But the real problem with water abuse is actually in rural areas, you know, where people have wells, so there's no monitoring what they're using whatsoever at all. Now, I don't actually know how the problem splits out.
Well, one of the things I had here as sort of a, you know, backup slide to today was one of the biggest problems actually is the amount of water that we use for agriculture in this country. You know, if you look at where water is used, forget the numbers on the, sorry, now that I look at it on the graph, but if you look at, you know, how much water is actually used for agriculture versus industrial, you know, versus, you know, this might be a part of the answer to your question. The amount of water that we use for agriculture is just obscene in this country. You know, if you think about one thing, for instance, you look at California. People are growing rice in California. Why grow rice in a state that has 1/10 of the rainfall that it requires to grow the crop? And that's because we've created, how many people have read Cadillac Desert? Okay, you should read Cadillac Desert. It's basically, it's ancient. It's absolutely ancient, but it's kind of a cult classic about the story of, you know, water in the west of the United States. And I think that it's something that definitely all of you should read. I'm just going to briefly go through the rest of these, and then I want to leave lots of time for questions. So other ideas, one of the students in the class was from Alaska, and he's got this very clever rainwater catchment system that comes off the roofs, and instead of all the water that runs off the roof, something like 10,000 gallons a year runs off the roof and is never reclaimed. Just literally catching that and then recycling that rainwater for use. You know, one of the simple things in your household, for instance, is why do we use potable water to flush our toilets? It's insane. So what he was talking about was then developing a second system, and I'm sure a lot of you are aware, but you know, when I was living in France, we had 2 water pipes coming into our house. I mean, one was grey water and the other was drinking water. So, you know, toilets, irrigation, anything ran off the grey water, and then you only used potable water where you needed it. You know, there's a sea change that's needed thinking in this country to bring that in. But one of the projects was for rural Alaska. How do you catch that water off the roof and then have a cistern to use that for your house? Interestingly enough, up until very recently, you weren't allowed to do that in the United States. So, in lots of municipalities in the United States, you know, if you did catch the water and put a cistern, it was against code. You weren't allowed to do that. But now we see with a lot of buildings in Seattle, like the new Gates building, the new Allen building, the Volcanus building, a building with, like, you know, million gallon cisterns of rainwater.
There's also issues in many states with water law. That water doesn't belong to you.
Yes.
That water may be allocated to somebody else. And so there's issues that have to be resolved legally with water rights for capturing that rain, diverting it from where it's naturally going.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you're kind of saying one of the single biggest problems in the United States in the developing world is solving that water rights problem. Who actually owns the water is huge. It's huge in eastern Washington here. It's kind of incredible. Some of the other things, the village hydropower generator, I talked about that one, the little sort of microturbine that can be used to provide light for kids in their huts at night. Grey water recycling. Phenomenal project from a student. She's Kenyan. Kenyan originally lived in Israel for a couple of years. Is over here for a year or two to work in the School of Aquaculture. One of the biggest problems with fish farming is the fact that it pollutes everything. So you have to have the fish farms very close to shore because they can't survive the currents and the waves and storms out at sea. And when you have them close to shore, you know, not only do the fish poop on everything and, you know, create all this fecal matter in the water, create the pollution problem, but then the fish get sick because there isn't enough flow through the tanks, so you pump them full of antibiotics, and that's what we're eating. You know, you're compounding, like, antibiotic-laden fish with the fact that we're destroying the environment with fecal matter that they produce. So fish farming is actually a very good idea if you can do it far out at sea, where there's enough water that can flow through the cages, you know, to keep the fish healthy. But the problem has always been that you can't actually keep those cages out there because every storm destroys them. So what she worked on this prototype that they developed in Israel, where they actually have these cages that you can sink when the weather gets really bad, and they stay intact that way through the storms. And they don't have to be that far offshore for this to work. So she wants to develop, she's looking for $6 million to develop a fish farm in Kenya using these sort of ecologically profound or sound principles. So the ideas here are just completely all over the map. They're really fun. There's a group of students of engineering working on a solar-powered desalination plant that they're going to enter in this. So these are just some of the ideas. Okay, so here are some of the deadlines, if any of you are interested. Just an intent to submit form is due on February the 11th. There is a website for this, which brilliantly I didn't stick on this presentation, but I'll forward. And then some sort of executive summary is due. But even if you're not competing, please come on April 1st and see some of this. These are going to be really cool projects. People are going to have demos. And it's in the hub. Is it on April 1st, Leo? There's a website, it's called eic.washington.edu, EIC for Environmental Innovation Challenge. So it's just eic.washington.edu. But the demo day will be really fun. And then the judges, so, you know, between sort of March 5th and March 29th, that's when we hook everybody up with somebody who's going to be a mentor to help them with their business model, you know, figure out the feasibility study. So this is where we answer questions, like I had students send me a question this week. You know, we have this desalination idea, but the only ones we know really that are good are Israel and in Saudi Arabia. You know, who can you help us hook up with here, you know, that'll help us work on it? Now, that one's going to take me a while, but they're the sort of questions we'll help you with. The other thing, and this is whether you're going to enter the competition or not, this is part of sort of the business plan competition cycle, but it's going to be phenomenal help to people who are working on the Environmental Innovation Challenge. In the winter quarter, every single Thursday night in the hub, from 6 to 7:30, there's what we call resource nights. So these are nights where, you know, if you want some help on figuring out the marketing piece, you know, like the feasibility study of your plan, somebody's going to come in and talk about, you know, how you would write a marketing plan. The week after, we've got somebody in who's going to talk about how would you do the finances, and then, you know, the other aspects are things like, if you want to start a company, the legal aspects. These are all free, they're open to everybody, there's usually cookies and things afterwards. It's a great way to meet other people who are participating in these competitions and sort of share ideas.
Have you considered webcasting these?
Right now, all we do is we had started videotaping them and putting them on them, but yeah, I don't know.
It seems to me that if the funding that you want to receive is out there for the folks that cannot make it to these meetings, so.
I don't believe they're webcast right now. One of the biggest problems we have with that is the cost of, you know, especially this year, the cost of having a videographer there is tough. Do you mean just sound? Or okay, so questions. If you have any questions that you don't want to ask here, that's my email. It's just EMER. It's really easy to remember. EMER, the first four letters of emergency. You'll never forget that. And then the woman who's actually running the program, the reason I actually found that out one time was when I was driving cross-country to move to Seattle, and my transmission broke in Ohio. So I called my boyfriend at the time to leave a message that said, call EMER at this number. And when he walked in, there's this sign on the board saying, call emergency, this number, because somebody had thought it was the short for emergency. So that's where that comes from. But it really helps people remember. So it's just EMER at u.washington.edu. Pamela Tufts is the person who's actually, you know, running the whole Environmental Innovation Challenge, and she's a phenomenal person for questions. So any questions about this, about the seminar, about the people, about the, you know, the whole thing? Yep.
The groups that participate in the challenge, you have to be a member, and one person be a student, and other people be working professionals?
Yeah, so the question is, do you have to be a student at the University of Washington to participate? And the answer is no. Yes, we do want students on the team, students presenting, but you know, we're really encouraging students to work with people off campus as well. You know, we're after the best ideas. So, for instance, the little Hydrovolts team, that's an idea that Burton Hamner, who's got his company Hydrovolts, he developed the turbine, but the students are developing the application for the developing world. So they're working with somebody externally.
And then you said that they don't have to be water-focused, they have energy.
They do not have to be water-focused, no. The theme this year is water, because we really wanted to shine a spotlight on an area that we think is underserved. But no, we already have, we've got a student who's working on a solar hydrogen-powered car. We've got somebody who's working on more efficient air compressors for building sites. You know, nothing to do with water. Yep.
There's one graduate in June, but this will be going on next year.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're graduating this year and you want to take part in this next year, you know, find some students this year. The other thing you're going to find out is that students participating this year would probably take their idea and refine it and come back next year. So go to the thing on April 1st and look at them and say, you know, hey, do you think it might be around next year?
Are there any innovations that are more along the policy or the non-tangible idea lines?
So the question is, are there any ideas that are, you know, purely the policy or the sort of non-tangible? And the answer is that's going to be tricky. Unless you can come up with a computer simulation or something that shows that because 50% of the sort of grading, not grading, but the competition score is going to go to that working prototype. Now, our interpretation of working prototype is going to be incredibly broad. So a computer simulation that shows something is perfectly fine, but a lot of them are going to be more tangible, hands-on. So it's going to be hard to do a pure conceptual piece for this one, but there's no time competition. You could. And the other thing is you can enter this, you know, get some experience of presenting to the judges, and then enter the business plan competition in May. Take it from there. The prize there is $25,000. The application process, so for the February 11th one, the intent to submit, literally, Sen, if you get on the website eic.washington.edu, just send an email to Pam Tufts or to me, and I'll put you in touch with the whole thing. But the application process, the intent to submit is just that. Here's my idea. You know, if you go to the website, it'll tell you what else you really want to put in there. And then you do need some sort of prototype or working or computer simulation or something. To enter, to be working on that. And that's the piece where you may be a little bit behind at this stage, because some people have been working on this since the fall. Cool. Any more questions?
How does this current economic climate going to affect all this? Is this going to increase it or decrease it?
Oh boy, now if I knew that. So the question is, you know, how's the current economic climate going to affect all this? Is it going to increase it or decrease it? That's a really hard question to answer. I'm incredibly involved in my other life, sort of in the startup community. I'm trying to raise a $5 million fund right now to invest in early stage companies. The market is horrendous, beyondly horrendous, to try and raise money for anything. But the interesting thing is that, you know, if you can do some of this and show people you're going to save money, there's huge emphasis right now on companies that are going to help, or ideas, help people or companies save money. And that's where the key is. If you can do that in this market, you're golden.
Can you explain the difference between angel funding and venture capitalists? And what motivates people to be an angel funder?
Oh, okay. So the question is, what's the difference between an angel funder? Now you're getting into my real area of interest. Angel funding and venture capital funding. So when you start a company, you're going to need some money to start a company. The vast majority of people start companies on their credit cards, you know, by selling their truck, by mortgaging their house. That's the way 99.9% of companies get funded in this country. Now then there's the 0.001%, and they don't add up, that get, you know, money from outside. It's called OPM, other people's money. So angel investors are generally wealthy individuals who have made their money as entrepreneurs, or they inherited it, or they've got family money, and they just get a kick out of seeing young entrepreneurs succeed. So their motivation for putting money in your company is, they love you, they love your idea, they think that this is going to be the next great thing. Totally different than venture capitalists. So angel investors tend to be wealthy individuals.
And around here, there are tons of them. Believe me, you know, the people that started companies like Jeff Husey. How many people know the company Classy Baby? Okay, really cool company just up in the Drummond Lakes. Jeff Bezos personally just put $1 million into that company. That's an angel investor. Most angel investors don't invest $1 million. They invest about $25,000 to $50,000 a shot. And they group together so a company can get paid $250,000 from angel investors. Venture capitalists, on the other hand, are a fund. So venture capitalists work, they raise money for a fund anywhere from $100 million to $1 billion in local companies. Local companies are like Voyager, Arch Venture, OVP, Ignition. These are all venture capitalists. So they raise money from mostly things like institutions, university endowments. A portion of the University of Washington endowment is invested in venture capital funds. You know, it's also invested in other equities and in, you know, real estate and bonds and treasuries. But a portion of it is invested in this very, very high risk, you know, venture capital. And then you have a group of partners who work for the venture fund. So they manage that, say, $200 million. So with that $200 million, they'll fund maybe 14 companies over the life of the company. They'll sort of put in $1 million maybe towards the beginning, and then maybe $5 million, and then $20 million later on, to the point that the company, you know, either goes public, is sold on the public exchange, and they get all the money back, or it's bought by another company. You know. So one of the local big successes lately was this company called In Situ. It was in some cases down near Corvallis, but it was actually in Washington, not in Oregon. But the company was an unmanned little airplane, and Boeing just bought it for $400 million. So the people who had invested sort of $1 million when the company was worth maybe $2 million made 200 times their money. So that's what venture capitalists do. Okay, any more questions? That's totally off topic of the environmental challenge. But, and I'll also hang out for a while if anybody just wants to ask or get, you know, my card or anything like that. So thanks, Millie.